you like that, I know you like everything the choir does. I hope you'll be back here, come back next Sunday. Next Sunday is going to be Choir Recognition Day, and we're recognizing the choir by letting them have a whole service from soup to nuts, both the choir and other musicians in our midst. I'm planning to sit out there with the rest of you and take it all in. So we look forward to next Sunday. The timing was too good to pass up. It came to my attention earlier in the week that this Sunday would mark to the very day the date on which our denominational body, the Unitarian Universalist Association, officially came into existence. Yeah, that would be May 15, 1961. So I decided the occasion was worth noting with a sermon. Playing off the Beatles motif here, I called it was 50 years ago today. Besides all that, I was having a very hard time getting my head wrapped around the topic I had sort of chosen, called transcending labels. I was wondering what on earth I was thinking when I thought up that one. Just couldn't get going with it. Perhaps sometime if I do get my head wrapped around it, I'll give you the sermon that comes out. Anyway, today it's a happy 50th UUA. I was officially admitted to the club, as it were, of the UU ministry in 1978. So my ministry within our association has covered 33 of the 50 years of its life, and 23 of those have been right here with you people in this church. I've been both a witness to and a participant in the ebbs and the flows, the push, the pull, the contentions and the high points that have happened over much of the life of our association. This morning I want to just touch on a few of the areas of that life. Over our next upcoming church year, I'll be returning to this topic on occasion in more detail than I'm doing today, because I want to share with you during next year, part of what I want to do next year is share with you some of my perspectives on the nature of our religious faith, our liberal religious faith, and how it has evolved over my time in the UU ministry. I want to do this not so much for the sake of a walk down memory lane, but rather as a way of looking ahead to where our movement and where this congregation, more importantly, where this congregation is a very strong and important part of that movement, may be going in the years to come. So you can consider this sermon this morning kind of like an overture to a series that I want to do off and on beginning in the fall. By 1960, the two religious bodies, the American Unitarian Association, the Universalist Church in America, they've been kind of flirting around with each other off and on for nearly a century earlier. Their theological differences were not all that great. Liberal Christianity remained more of a central focus within Universalism than it did with Unitarianism by the mid-19th century, but a fair number of both Unitarian and Universalist ministers by then had signed on to what was called the Humanist Manifesto. Both bodies had their mix of theists and humanists and liberal Christians and those of various other persuasions. We'd become pretty eclectic even by then. Their main differences have always, had long been, much more cultural than theological. In admittedly broad, perhaps overly broad, demographic strokes, the Universalists were more of a working class, kind of a blue-collar denomination, while the Unitarians were more of a professional and a more academically oriented body. Of course, there were exceptions on both sides to that. The Universalists took a harder hit during the Depression than did the Unitarians. They unfortunately had to close many of the doors to their churches during that time. And as the more mainline Protestant denominations went in a more moderate to liberal direction, the Universalists kind of lost their edge, as it were, on the liberal Christian market, to put it in crass terms. By the end of the Second World War, during which time the Unitarians and the Universalists worked together on various relief and recovery efforts in Europe, they decided it was finally time to move past the flirtation stage and get serious about a marriage, realizing that they would be much better off as a single united body instead of two smaller ones, each appealing to basically the same segment of the general population. Well, even with that decision, it was a 10 or more year courtship, and something of a kind of a boring courtship at that, with various joint committees and consolidation committees working together and hammering out agreements and bylaws and other such tedious institutional stuff, before the final votes to consolidate were taken by the delegates from both of those organizations in May of 1960, with the formal joining taking place, as noted, on May 15th of the following year. Meanwhile, here at Nashua, Unitarians and Universalists were actually ahead of the curve. When the minister of the Universalist Church retired, I believe it was in 1956 or 57, their building is still standing down on the corner of Main and Pearl Street. It's an office building now. That congregation had become pretty small. The powers that be in both churches decided it was time for them to merge, even while the powers that be at the denominational levels were still getting things worked out. So, there was a Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua a few years before there was a UUA. And the first minister of the newly formed UU congregation here in this community was my predecessor, the Reverend Donald Rowley. And so while the overall history of this church goes back to its founding in 1826, I am only the second minister that the Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua has had. Well, back to the larger picture. The past half century of Unitarian Universalism has played out against the backdrop of some of the great issues of our society, great issues our society at large has faced over the course of that time. Issues like race, war and peace, gender equality, sexual orientation. And each of these, in turn, have had their impact upon our congregations. I will give them, of necessity, something of a flyby this morning. Our denomination came into existence just as the civil rights movement was gaining energy and visibility. And while we were and are a predominantly white religious body, our response in those early civil rights movement days was quite remarkable. One of the more iconic pictures or images from that time within our UU family is one that shows the first president of our association, Dr. Dana McLean Greeley, walking kind of with locked arms with several other religious leaders from various parts of the United States and with Martin Luther King at the center of their line. They were participating in the 1965 Selma to Montgomery March that Dr. King was leading. The UUA Board of Directors happened to be meeting at that time, that very momentous event in our nation's history, and they tabled their business and they adjourned so that as many of them as could go to Selma to answer Dr. King's call to the religious leaders of America, which he had put out both clergy and lay, asking them to come there and to join him. The horribly tragic note to all of that is that one of those UU ministers who answered the call, the Reverend James Reeb, was beaten to death on the streets of Selma by members of the Ku Klux Klan as he was returning from a restaurant where he'd eaten. He was 38 years old. He left a wife and four children. Dr. King rearranged the schedule of activities of the Selma to Montgomery March in order to hold a memorial service for Reverend Reeb. One of our congregations today in Madison, Wisconsin, is named in his honor and memory. The euphoria of those days, even tempered as they were with Reverend Reeb's death, were even greatly more tempered just a few short years later within our UU family by what is now called the Black Empowerment Controversy. This is a much larger and much more intricate story than I can tell here, but it had to do with a clash over which kinds of models best serve the cause of racial justice. Was it empowerment or was it integrationist? And the clash got to be over how our denominational resources should best be used in that cause. Somehow, just the way the situation was then, a both-on approach, both-and approach, with both of those models could not be reached. It was a very painful time. It created a rift within our UU family, and in many of our congregations, it took some time to heal. As I say, it's a bigger story than can be told now, but we do continue as a body to struggle with issues of race and class in our congregations today, and how we break through our narrow demographic of race and class is one of those still ongoing challenges before us and that will continue to remain before us, even as we do struggle and come to terms with it. By the mid to late 1960s, the effects of the Vietnam War were being felt within our association and within our congregations. And here again, there was some tension. Many of our clergy became very vocal opponents of our participation in that conflict. General Assembly resolutions were passed questioning the wisdom of the war, urging support for those who dissented from it. This was shortly before I came into the association myself. But there was no unanimity within our congregations on the issue, at least not in its earliest days, before larger public opinion itself went sour on the war. And a number of our ministers faced the challenge of speaking their own opinions, their own truths when it came to the war, while also trying to hear the various voices in their congregations and trying to keep their congregations in a unity of spirit, even when there was not unanimity of opinion. In other ways, this too remains an ongoing challenge for both ministers and lay leaders in our congregations today. That is to say, speaking their truth, taking their stand on the one hand, while keeping the atmosphere free and safe enough for an open exchange of opinions and ideas on the other, on any number of topics. The two issues, I would have to say, that have had their greatest impact on our congregations since I came through the door in 78, though, have been those of gender and sexual orientation. I'm going to first take up the latter. Several years ago, I had a chance meetup with Reverend Gene Robinson shortly after he became the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire, the first openly gay man to do so, and from which he has recently announced his retirement, which is still pending. It was a very hurried conversation we had. It was at the Manchester airport as we were waiting for different flights. I just happened to see him sitting there. I told him that my own denomination had had to struggle with matters of gay, lesbian, transgender acceptance and affirmation going back some 30 plus years, that it was a process that we had been able to work through now to a very positive, uplifting, I think, and affirmative place. And then I added, I felt it was with persons like him in positions of leadership, the Episcopal Church could do the same. Unfortunately, it appears that this issue is dividing the Episcopates in ways that it ultimately did not do with us, even as their story goes on and as their outcome remains undetermined. I have to say, however the issue goes with that religious body, I will always regard Bishop Robinson as a very wonderful, very brave individual. I say we came to a positive place, but it was not without some tension now and then. I remember in the early 1980s, the persuading it took to get the board of the UU Church I was serving up in Maine to agree to open up our facility to a gay support group in the area, a group who at that time was, and in that place, was still staying largely under the radar. With some hesitation, with some conversation, they did agree to do that, and that was considered a significant step at that time. And I was never more proud of a congregant, I don't think, during my whole time in the ministry today, than I was in those days, when one of my members of the congregation I served there, who was also the majority leader of the Maine State Senate, and a Republican, I will add, used a good chunk of his political capital in order to get a non-discrimination bill for sexual orientation passed. Again, that was considered a significant step in those days. His name was Sam Collins. He's very elderly now. He's long out of politics. And he is the uncle of Maine's United States Senator Susan Collins. Well, the larger story of our association's dealings with matters of sexual orientation is yet another one of those sermons in and of itself. It's a story with its proud moments, a story with its difficult moments. I hope to be able to tell that more fully at a later date. The biggest change in our movement, though, over the past half century, demographically, philosophically, theologically, operationally, every other kind of Ellie you can think of, has had to do with gender. First district meeting I attended when I came to that first UU church I served up in Maine really did look like an old boys club, even though us guys in it, like me, were still wet behind our ministerial ears. And I can remember the first woman minister who came into our midst. She must have been a very lonely soul, far more than us guys could have ever understood or appreciated at the time. But she was at the crest of a wave that would very soon thereafter swept across our whole liberal religious movement, and which is now also sweeping through mainline Protestantism in this country as well. And as that wave made its impact, the outcome went far beyond just simply witnessing the presence of as many women as men in our UU pulpits. What really happened is that the face of our faith in many ways did change. I cannot reduce the cause of that change to just the increased presence of women in the UU ministry, but there's a connection there that cannot be discounted either. The nature of the sea change of Unitarian Universalism over the past 30 years is yet again the stuff of several sermons. I can give you a few notes in this birthday overture. A quick perspective, again with an admittedly broad brush. From the time of our birth in 1961, and on up through the late 1970s, I would say, the emphasis in many of our congregations was on offering a religion that was intellectually defensible, that would stimulate the mind, that would challenge and refute old superstitions and beliefs that were, to put it bluntly, an insult to the thoughtful mind. And with all of that built around a generally humanist perspective, ours was overwhelmingly a religion of the head. That is to say. And that is all well and good and fine. Well and good and fine up to a point, that is. One term, fairly or not, used to characterize many of our services from that time was that of a hymn sandwich. That is to say, a sermon given in between a couple of reasonably singable hymns with a few other items put in there as well. There wasn't a whole lot at all going on in the way of chalice lightings, or candles of joys and concerns, or singing Spirit of Life, or starting off a service by singing Hallelujah, or any of that other spiritual stuff. That just wasn't what we did. Our goal was to offer a kind of religion that was free from some of the emotional excesses of other religious bodies, and free from the demands of dogma. Again, well and good. We did that. We still do a good job of that, I feel. But some important pieces, again, speaking in broad terms here, some important pieces were missing from our worship lives, and by extension from our congregational lives. We didn't fully grasp the implications of the fact that persons come into a religious community, however liberal-minded it may be, with both their heads and their hearts, with body, mind, soul, and spirit, with their whole selves in need of spiritual nurture and feeding. And I don't think it is a coincidence that our worship services across our association took on a more holistic, expressive, affective tone as women began to take our pulpits, become our worship leaders, and move in to places of leadership. At the time of the 1961 consolidation, our very worship language was very heavily male-dominated. The bond of union that was crafted for our new association's bylaws and the predecessor of our correct purposes and principles was all about the dignity of man, the worth of man, and the like. A new hymnal was published for our new association. Had it back here somewhere. A new hymnal was published by our association from the early 1960s. It was called Hymns for the Celebration of Life. It even had two sections in it, a section of responsive readings and a section of hymns that were simply titled Man. It's called the Blue Hymnal. And by the 1980s, that rationale that, oh yeah, well, we need women too, that just wasn't really cutting it anymore. And so we crafted a new set of purposes and principles that were enacted in 1985. We got ourselves a new hymnal, the one you have out there now, called the Gray Hymnal, called Singing the Living Tradition. both our current purposes and principles, excuse me, and our current hymnal, completely gender inclusive, both demonstrate our attempts as well to nurture the spirit and the heart as well as the mind. And again, while it was men and women working together to do both these things, I don't think such changes would have taken place without the large influx of women into our ministry and into the life of our association over the past 2 to 3 decades. Well, we're still a work in progress. We continue to be a living tradition. And such is the beauty, I feel, of this liberal religious faith of ours. It's never finished. It's never completely set in stone. And since I entered our ministry over 30 years ago, yet another generation of clergy has come into it now with their own ideas, their own leadership styles, and they will continue with this ongoing evolution. They will bring about ever new expressions of this thing called Unitarian Universalism. And so I look forward to another year with you. And then I look forward to seeing the ministry here taken up by someone from another younger generation of UU ministers than the one I represent, and see where they and you go with that. And so I wish our association a happy 50th. I thank it for being there when I needed a place to go in order to continue being a minister, when the faith into which I was originally ordained 40 years ago this June, as a matter of fact, no longer worked for me. I look ahead at our liberal faith with a mixture of hope and concern. Unless I set some record for human longevity, which I'm not counting on, I will not be around to wish the UUA a happy 100th. I can look around. Maybe some of you in this room here will make that. Who knows? I certainly hope that some of those children, young people in that next building over there will be able to congratulate our faith tradition on a happy 100th. That's not just going to happen willy-nilly, though. Yet another sermon reflection I want to offer you in the upcoming year are my thoughts on what our liberal faith and what our denominational body need to do, in fact, if we are going to be around in 2061. What gives me the most hope along these lines is knowing that as long as we have enough strong and vibrant congregations, like the one I am blessed to serve here, then we will remain a vital force in the religious landscape of our land. Small, no doubt, but still vital. We cannot take that for granted, however. We have to keep working to make it happen. Well, just as I changed my sermon topic for today, I changed the closing hymn. When the ceremony was held at Boston Symphony Hall to mark the joining of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America, the hymn that they sung for that occasion was quite an appropriate one. It lasted through both of our blue and our gray hymnals. It's the one we're going to close with now, As Tranquil Streams, number 145. Let's sing that together.